You have brought along a list of names here. How many? 80?
Yeah, I've got around 88 names.
Can you scan down there and just bring some of them up? And maybe somebody listening to this would be interesting to know that you have mentioned them.
Well, of course, I mentioned Sid and Lee Earhart, Ray Billing, Leroy Randall, who was a great photographer for the world during the war years and who died untimely. Jack Kinsey, who was a desk man and close friend of mine. As a matter of fact, the picture that I sent you of me at a typewriter in 1954, Jack just showed up one day and took that picture. Why? I don't know. I think he was experimenting with the camera.
Liked your red Argyle socks, by the way.
John Gold was probably the quintessential city editor. I said at his funeral that we all aspired to be as good as John, but none of us ever made it. John was city editor 20 years from 60 through 80. He was a very, very outstanding guy. Troy Gordon was one of my old friends. Troy died fairly young. He and Julie Blakely, who was a society editor for many years, as I put it, raised me around the world. I mean, they made me feel welcome, and they kidded and joked and so on and made me feel like a part of the world and taught me a great deal about just getting around.
Troy had his own column, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He wrote Round the Clock. He didn't originate that, but he made it what it was. And for a period there in the 60s, it was very, very good. His wife, Joanne Gordon, was a good feature writer and a good news reporter. Now, here's a name that not many people, I suspect, remembers, that the society editor when I started was named Maureen Halliburton. And I used to get in trouble with her because I was supposed to go back on Thursday night, gather up her copy, take it and deliver it to the composing room. I would forget it, and she took offense at that. She thought I was picking on her because she was a society editor and a woman and so on, and she pretty well straightened me out a couple of times. There's a woman that's still alive. Elmira Smith was a young woman in society in those days. There was a woman named Sabra Smith whose claim to fame one time said had a really tough operation. They took out a big part of his stomach. This is in the early 60s. Sid was a very soft voiced guy. It's hard to hear him. And Sabra won undying fame around the newsroom. When she heard about Sid's operation, she said, well, I hope they turn up his volume while they're in there. Of course, I mentioned Charlie Clark that I succeeded. Charlie Smith succeeded me and I succeeded him. There was a good friend of mine who died here a couple of years ago named Chuck Wheat, who, when I went on the paper, was the part-time desk man, a brilliant guy. He was a great reporter, and then he left there and became a speechwriter for some of the very big oil people and spent a whole career there. A fellow named Young Mitchell, who was on the desk later in the oil department. I later worked with him as a desk man when I came back in 71. His wife was Margaret Smith, who was the daughter of Marshall Smith, who was the editorial page editor before Walter, way back there. John Turner was a sports writer that not many people remember. He was in the department when he came in. We had two John Fergusons. There was Little Fergie, we called him. I can't remember what their middle initials were, but this other Ferguson was a big, obscene, bawdy kind of a guy. He's really a lovable character, but he was something. It was a guy named Jack Kelly who was in the sports department and later on was a reporter and a friend of mine. Tom Lobaugh, that you may remember, he covered golf for 100 years right there, it seemed like. The sports editor was named B.A. Bridgewater. He had been the managing editor of the old Evening World. World published an evening paper for a while in the 30s. Then he came back on as the sports editor and stayed there. I later worked with his son, Dolph Bridgewater. It was Bernard Adolphus Bridgewater, their names. Old Dolph, we called him, was a big old guy, and he was an assistant county attorney with David Hall. But Bridge, everybody called him Bridge, was a big friend of Sam Avey. In those days, he had the Coliseum, and they did the Baby's Milk Fund. We promoted that, wrestling, and all that kind of stuff. I made the mistake one time of calling him Bilgewater. These detractors called him Bilgewater. He straightened me out pretty quick. Bill Connors was in college at the time I came on, and he came on, I think, full-time in about 55 and later became, of course, the premier sports editor and columnist for the world, a guy of tremendous ability. Sid Steen told me in later years that he wanted Bill to become his managing editor, and he offered Bill the job, and Bill said, no, smart guy. Chuck Bales was the old boy from Sand Springs that I knew and worked with for years. A fellow named Joe Cannon, I'm just thinking of the names in the newsroom. He covered aviation, and I don't know what happened to Joe. There's a guy named John Clayton. John was, let's call it, the ace of the staff, or one of the top reporters when I came on. And I learned something from John, and he doesn't even know that I learned it. Picked up a piece of his copy one night. The sheriff's department had bought a new airplane. I was always impressed because I picked up the story that he wrote about that. He had written a lead, and it was just a simple statement. Said, the sheriff has a new airplane. Period, paragraph, that was it. That was about as short a lead as you could get. But we prided ourselves on writing very short leads to get the reader, we thought, into it. We used to kid old Don Batchelder, who I mentioned in here, someone who was a very close friend of mine. We were in college together and later worked together. Old Batch was doing obits, and they kept telling him to write shorter leads, write shorter leads, write shorter leads. So he turned one in and said, dead, period, paragraph. That's what he was. He was quite a clown. Of course, I mentioned Curtis, and I already mentioned Finley. One of the City Hall reporters before Travis was a fellow named Cecil Brown. I didn't know Cecil very well. I just met him, and then I read stuff later. Travis, I mentioned, I knew him. Chuck Satterley was a desk man. He was probably one of the most brilliant guys you'd run into, but he was so irascible that nobody could get along with him. He was one of the fellows that just backed you in the corner when he was talking to you. Then there was Harold Davis. He was the weekend wire editor when I was copy boy. He would send me across to a little cafe every night to get a jar of bean juice. I remember old Harold, and he had worked for the New York Herald American. I think he had a drinking problem, so he was coming down to the minor league, so to speak, but he was a very capable guy, and everybody thought a lot of Harold. I remember he was left-handed, and the composing room would almost nightly send me back to Harold to find out what this was, because he could hardly read his handwriting. Some of these were people that we called gypsies in those days. They were floaters. They'd come in temporarily, work 4 or 5 months, be gone to another newspaper and so on. Sid would hire them because you needed the help, and they were cheap, I guess. A fellow named Dudley Early was one of those guys. My introduction to him, I went back to the men's room one night, and poor Dudley was back there just sweating and straining and so on, and he had broken the zipper on his pants, and he couldn't get his pants zipped up. So he sent me out, and I rounded up some safety pins for him. And then there was Nita Hendricks Connor. Her name was Nita Hendricks at the time I went in. She was a receptionist and was a receptionist forever. She ultimately married Bill Connors. Angie Henthorne was the editor of the paper at the time. Paul Hedrick was the old original oil editor that knew the original Lorton, Eugene Lorton. I worked for him. Clarence Mantooth was really the oil editor, the guy I worked for. A fellow named John Sparks that worked in the oil department. Yvonne Litchfield. I mentioned Don Batchelder, a good friend of mine, now dead. Carol Griffey, who was Batchelder's nemesis and his classmate at TU. Batch got in trouble with her because they were team reporting at TU one time, and Batch was calling Carol, and she was writing the story they were practicing, being a rewrite in Legman at the time. So they had a name misspelled. Of course, Griffey was mad at Batch because he gave her the wrong spelling, and they both got an F on their paper. Tom Wood, who gave the F, was a TU professor who worked at the Tulsa World many times. A very excellent guy. I mentioned Ed Johnson, who was head of the department. Riley Wilson, one of the kind, was a reporter when I went there and subsequently was sent back as the oil editor in about early 57, I guess. Fenton Harris. Now, there's a name that not many people remember. I remember Fenton very well because I don't know whether it was on the first night that I was on the job, but it was very early on. Fenton corners the new copy boy, that's me, and said, say, could I borrow a dollar? And said, well, I'm sorry, I don't have a dollar. And I reached in my pocket and pulled out the change I had, and he looked at it, and he grabbed it and said, that'll do. Jack Fincher was the name. Marvin Southwick worked for the Tribune, I think, but he was back in our newsroom. Woody Gaddis was a photographer and a good friend of mine. So was John Whitworth. I've mentioned Julie, and I could talk about Julie for hours. Matter of fact, Julie was fatally ill. She was living in California. I had exchanged letters with her. She wrote and said that when the time comes, she wanted me to write her obituary. So when Julie died, I just wrote a feature about Julie. First time I'd ever been assigned an obituary by the person who was going to die, but I did it for Julie. Nick Foltz was the desk man. Judy Otterstrom, later was Judy Randall. Dana Sue Walker, you may have heard about her. Brenda Heck was one of her buddies back there. There's a woman named Jackie Stringer. I mean, I remember her because there was an incident where I dragged Julie and Jackie out of the Horseshoe Lounge in a loud voice saying, "Mama, I've told you 100 times not to blow your check in here." Phil Dessauer, I mentioned. Malvina Stevenson was the world's correspondent in Washington when I was state editor. Ken Jackson was a desk man when I showed up, and later he went to Chicago as a PR guy, later came back to the world. Great reporter. Bill Sansing was the AP man. Toby LaForge, of Cat Creek Carol fame. Old Toby worked for the Tribune for years and years and years, and he would write a little bit of doggerel right in front of a lot of his features, which he called the Cat Creek Carols. He'd kind of fall on hard times, and I think the Trib let him go for various reasons. I won't say what, but Sid, who had worked with him and knew him very well, hired him. Well, Toby was a wonderful old guy. I mean, he was just a grizzled veteran old newspaper man, and he wore glasses about that thick, and he couldn't see through them even then. He was just across the aisle from me, and I'd hear him, and he would start out every conversation, "Hun, this is Toby." I mean, he'd call the White House and say, "Hun, this is Toby." Well, Sid was within earshot, and he'd hear that. So every now and then he'd say, "Toby, you need to identify yourself better than 'Hun, this is Toby.'" And so for a while you'd hear old Toby over, and he'd say, "This is Wallace LaForge, a reporter at the Tulsa Daily World." But then about 3 days later, it was back to, "Hun, this is Toby." I heard him one night dealing with an accident situation in which someone had been killed, but the family didn't know about it. Toby called the family and found out that they had not heard the news yet. And I remember just thinking, boy, he knew how to handle that because he was very, very understanding and tactful. Then there was Herb Carner, who was our farm editor, and saw him here just the other day. He had a right-hand guy named Dobie Sherrill. We had Brother Robert, who was the son of one of the early mortuaries here in town. Brother Robert would come in. He always had on an overcoat, and he always had a wilted rose in it. He'd just shuffle along, and he'd go through all the wastebaskets. I mean, he was just kind of one of those guys. I mean, everybody knew him, and never did figure out what he was looking for, because in those days we had 60-gallon drums mounted on wheels, and the cleaning ladies would come along and pick up all of that paper that we developed. It would just be a barrel of paper, literally, nothing in there. But Brother Robert nosed around through that, never did find out much about him. Had an old gal named Nurse Irene that really was a nurse, and she was just full of conspiracies. She'd call you and say, "Go to page 14 on the classified ads." Yes. And said, "Now you see where it says dog for sale?" Yeah. "Now mark that and turn it over on the other side. Now on the other side of it, you'll find a story that says so and see if somehow she concocted a conspiracy about all that."
Was she a reader?
She just a character that would show up in the newsroom, just
okay,
come wandering in. And
yep.
She was widely tolerated. You know, in those days, we didn't even have any guards downstairs. You'd just walk in, and when a guy would come in with a briefcase, the reporters would all run, because he'd walk up to the city desk, and the city editor, in order to get rid of him, would assign him back to a reporter. Some of the real characters would come in, you know, and one night there was a very good-looking Indian fellow. I mean, he was a tribal kind of guy, real well-dressed. Had a big briefcase, and he walked up and talked to Ray Billings a little while. Ray told him, said, "Well, go back here and talk to Toby." Toby was on the phone. This guy sat down there and got his briefcase out and got all of his stuff out. But old Toby after he hung up the phone, he was looking at that guy, and he said, "Now, son, what kind of a thing are you trying to sell?" That was his opening words. Howard Hopkins was a freelance photographer around Tulsa who ran Hopkins Photography. We knew Hoppy real well. Bill Ellis was a reporter that was in there for a while. Bill had the dirtiest copy you've ever seen, but it was good. I mean, it looked like it had been written on a pencil and edited on a typewriter. He was a good, good feature writer, but so many of those guys were hunting peckers, you know. They just... There's a guy named Ken Frakes that later worked at University of Tulsa. I affectionately called him Great Nuts Frakes. But Dale Spear, who was a very young guy, and I christened him Baby Huey because he looked a lot like that cartoon character, you know, or we thought he did. He was very offended by that. Alan Girdler was a police reporter. Roscoe Turner, who's mad at me because when I showed up there, I remember him running the elevator. We used to have an elevator operator, and when she went to lunch, Roscoe would run the elevator. I think he worked on the janitorial staff. He was a young man, you know, he's about my age.
You're talking about Roscoe Turner, who became a city councilor.
Oh, yeah. Lou Ann Ruark, who was a senior when I was a freshman, and I knew her for a long, long time. Maurice DeVenna, a real character, who was a fine arts editor. And there are all kinds of stories about Maurice that I won't even go into. But Maurice was an honorary French consul. I mean, the French government had conferred that on him, and Maurice took it seriously. This is one story. One night he was caught drunk driving, and they were trying to book him, and he claimed diplomatic immunity. Tried to. And the police said, "Well, okay, we'll let you do that, but we're going to deport you, you know." Sid was always bailing Maurice out. Of course, Maud Lawton Myers was our publisher in those days. I mean, she'd succeeded the old man when her husband died. Byron Boone was the lawyer for the paper and later became the publisher. You mentioned Alex. I've already said Alex came to work there for the UP in the early 60s. Subsequently, I think I mentioned him.
Yes, you have, and the fact that you two have a very close relationship
to this day. We're still very close. And till this day, I'd as soon have lunch with Alex as anybody I know, and we must have gone to lunch, I don't know, on the average of 3 times a week, because he always has such a good take on things. Very interesting. He's a Civil War expert, just a magnificent history guy. I mean, he will read something and then tell me all about the book he's read, and said, "Well, I don't need to read it. You already told me about it." He's really a good conversationalist and so much fun. One of the real characters was Lula Egan Quinlan. But Lula, bless her heart, was about 5 feet tall. Looked like she wore the same dress all the time. She had a little old hat that she would wear that had a feather on the top of it. She was always working in the garden, and when she came in, she never bothered to change her clothes or anything, and she was quite a character. Every year, she would tell people when to plant seeds and so on, and we had a picture that could be run. It was exactly 3 columns long and 1 column wide. So you could run it as a 3-column or a 1-column, and it had 3 plates. And theoretically, they had seeds in there that she could identify. As a practical matter, you could run it upside down, crossways, any way you want to. And every year, she'd want us to run that with her column. It came timed, so we'd dutifully do that. When I was state editor, it became my duty, among other things, to edit Lula's garden column. Well, she was not very happy with me. She called me Old Neil the Axe Man. What she would do, she had a number of publishers, and she would put a few favorable words about X book or whatever right at the end. So, you know, they'd send her books and so on. It was so long, I got to where I'm just quacking it off. So I woke up one day and she had inserted that real high in her column on the theory that I'd cut from the bottom. But my favorite story about her is I was state editor and it was a real hot summer day and she wanted to deliver a column. She called me and said, "Now, would you come down on the street there and get my column so I don't have to park?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I'll be glad to." Well, I forgot her. And pretty soon she got off the elevator, and boy, it was one of those Donald Duck scenes where she was so mad. She's a little old lady about this high, And she announced in a loud voice, "Okay, which one of you forgot me?" she was something. There's a young reporter named Fred Davis. There's no guy that was named Jack Eldridge, who was a PR man for a circus that came to town every year. And old Jack would come in. Of course, we all got free circus tickets and all that kind of stuff. But he had free rein. There was a guy named Dave Wood, who was a good reporter, kind of if you could keep him sober. I remember he covered the 1957 liquor conspiracy trials. Did a good job on that. We had a fellow named John Lawrence, who they assigned to be the medical reporter, not knowing that John was a Christian Scientist. And old John was famous for two remarks that he'd make around here. Somebody would call him and want him to do something. He said, "Look, partner, I can't help you." He said, "I just load the trucks." Or he would say, "Well, we got a new managing editor. I guess we're going to have to go out and paint the rocks." And that kind of stuff. He was something. Well, that's enough of them. I know those names will ring bells with a lot of people, and some of them won't.
But the fact that you recalled all those names.
I've probably forgotten some of them, but their incidents connected with them had helped me to remember some of it. Now, you understand that my memory's better about those days than it is last week.
I'm going to ask you, what were you listing there?
I tried to remember some of the printers. There was a guy named Jerry Slankard that was a shop foreman when I showed up. There was another guy named Oscar something. I forgot his last name. One of my good friends was Glenn Cronister from Sand Springs. We called old Glenn Cronister the monster. He came puffing in one day to tell me that Bud Caffey, who was a county commissioner for District 2 out in western Tulsa County, was grading a place in Osage County. A place called M's Club, which was this kind of a little dugout place and kind of a night spot. I mean, you know, just a sleazy place. And old Bud was spreading gravel on the parking lot, scattering it and all that kind of stuff. So we sent a photographer out there and got a picture of the District 2 equipment at M's Club. We ran a little story on it. Bud came in to explain to us. I think maybe I called him that night and talked to him, but he said that that was a school bus turnaround, that was the only place that they could figure out to have a school bus turnaround because there's a little school down south in Tulsa County. So he was grading that school bus turnaround. But Bud was a politician. So sure enough, the next night, here came Bud, who was about 6'3", and a guy that was even bigger than Bud. They came stomping into the newsroom to talk to yours truly. And this was the principal of that little school. And he claimed that, yeah, that's what it was, and so on and so on. But anyway, it's one of those lessons that if Bud had ignored that, it would have gone away. But they came in, well, then we had to write a story.
Yeah.
So it went on and on. I later came to really appreciate old Bud. He did some things. For example, he got Wiley Hissom to donate the land for Hissom. He got Claude Chandler to donate the land for Chandler Park. Bud did all right himself. One time he was graveling church parking lots, which was technically illegal. But, of course, the church folks were very appreciative of that. He could do no wrong. So the Tribune was uncovering those church parking lots one by one. Every time they'd get one, they'd write a big story about it. Old Bud called an editorial writer at the time named Bill Henthorne. This is the world guy. I can hear him saying this. Said, "Bill, if I'd give you a list of all the parking lots that I've graveled, would you print her?" And old Bill said, "Oh, yeah." So Bud brought the list over, and we printed the list, and it killed the Tribune's expose dead in the water. But Bud's idea of public property was any piece of land owned by more than two people. That was pretty common in those days, actually. And listen, I'm just prattling on here.
This is great.